back out to the floor to practice after the game, as workers were cleaning the arena. Another example of him mimicking Kobe Bryant. But the Cavs won again and were riding a 6-game win streak as they prepared to leave for the West Coast. On Christmas Eve, the team boarded their plane for a long flight to California. It was the marquee Christmas matchup on the schedule, a rematch with the Warriors, who were sitting at a sparkling 26-1, waiting for the Cavs, who were 19-7. For the first time since Christmas Eve the year before, the day when they learned that Anderson Varejao had torn his Achilles, the team was fully healthy, just in time for a huge game. With health and the win streak, there was finally a feeling of stability within the team. Now that they were settled and whole, they believed everything would calm down. After everything they'd been through, they should have known better. Chapter 13, Theater of the Absurd. Christmas is a massive day on the NBA calendar. The season is technically about 7 weeks old, but with football winding down and most of America gathered with family, it has become the league's time to reintroduce itself to casual fans. A lot of planning goes into the matchups, and there are special uniforms, special shoes, and even special commercials to take marketing advantage of the profile. For a player, being involved in a Christmas Day game is an honor, even as it puts a strain on families. The Cavs had a brutal trip around the holiday, 4 games in 5 nights across the West. Still, they were amped for their rematch with the Warriors in Oakland. The Warriors were undefeated at home, not having lost there since the Cavs won Game 2 in the finals. This time the Cavs were healthy. No complaints about the Warriors not having to deal with Kyrie Irving or Kevin Love, and they expected to play their style. What happened was a little surprising. Whether it was specifically David Blatt's game plan or not, the Cavs fell right back into their finals mode. They went slow and big, trying to bruise the quick and slick Warriors. Like it was June again, Blatt slashed his rotation and benched Richard Jefferson, who had been performing well as LeBron James's backup, and he cut Mo Williams's playing time. Irving and Love played terribly. They combined to go 0-11 from three-point range. It was an ugly slugfest. Even Steph Curry looked off as he missed 9 of his 15 shots. It was hardly a showcase for the league's 2 best teams. The slowdown pace kept the game close, but the Warriors ended up winning by 6, 89-83. It was by far Golden State's lowest scoring game. The Warriors had scored more than 115 points 15 times already. It broke a stretch of 47 straight home games where they scored at least 100 points, and yet they walked out with a 27-1 record. What followed was another throwback to the previous year, attacks on the Cavs coach. Blatt had not articulated his game plan effectively to the players, and they were upset at how things unfolded. It's going to take some time to get back into rhythm, and all of us, not just the players, but everyone, to get back into rhythm, James said, breaking his string of Blatt support with a thinly veiled shot. Surprising, Richard Jefferson said about not playing. Just because it was one of those games you look forward to as a player. I hadn't played on Christmas Day in 12 years. Now, 13 years. There's not been a lot of communication right now, said Anderson Varejao, who had been in and out of the lineup, just waiting to see what's going to happen. There were a number of reasons the Cavs lost, but there was no missing that the players were put off by Blatt's approach and how they hadn't been included. Blatt was in a challenging spot. He'd just gotten his whole team healthy and had to transition to having more players. He didn't make his choices clear to the team, though, and it triggered blowback. The key thing in any relationship on any good team, with any staff, with any group, is communication, Jefferson said. The next night, the team played in Portland, and they were in a sour mood. Irving was not yet cleared to play on back-to-back days yet, so he sat and the lineup changed again. From the opening moment, the team looked like it wasn't collectively interested in being there. It may not have been a direct boycott aimed at Blatt, but it was a negative response. From his seat in the stands, team general manager David Griffin was alarmed. It was stunning how down his team was playing. He was already concerned that they were too uptight, that there was a missing enjoyment that accompanied their success. The Warriors always had fun when they played. The Cavs did not, even when they won sometimes, a tone that was often spearheaded by James. Griffin had been tracking this for some time, but it manifested itself that night. The Blazers had a great shooting night, drilling a bunch of three-pointers in the opening minutes, but the Cavs looked to just quit at the challenge. The score was a shocking 34-12 after the first quarter and finished 105-76. For the first 8 weeks, we had built chemistry. We knew who was playing, we knew who wasn't playing, James said. We have no rhythm. We have some guys who don't know if they're going to play or if they aren't going to play, and it's hurting our rhythm a little bit. That was diplomatic. Many on the team were fuming. Blatt knew there were issues, and he discussed it with Griffin. After a day off to cool down, he called a team meeting the morning of a game in Phoenix and tried to refocus the team. In tough times, you've got to show a little bit of leadership and lift your troops, Blatt told Cleveland.com about the meeting. That was the whole purpose of it, to fire them up a little bit and lift them up a little bit. They certainly this year have been doing their part, and I had to step in and do something myself. The Suns were a weak team, and it was a pretty messy game, though the Cavs played better than in Portland. They probably couldn't have played worse. Irving returned and scored 22 points, making a late three-pointer that carried the Cavs to a four-point win. That relieved some pressure, but the team's body language was off. James played most of the game with a scowl and barked at teammates when they made mistakes. The problem was, he was making mistakes too. In a sign of where his head was at, he took just 10 shots and had just 14 points. The unrest was centered on Blatt, James's previous game plan to be supportive having been suspended. With James setting the mood, the locker room was tense even following a win. The look on James's face was telling. He was like a coiled snake, sending out strong warnings to stay away. "Guys, we won the game," James Jones said. "That should be the only thing that matters." During the road trip and for much of the season, Griffin was in the locker room to witness it. He was deeply concerned by what he was seeing and what he was feeling. Never before in his 24 years in the league had he sensed so much bubbling anger after a victory. This was a win, breaking a losing streak, and all he saw was a dispirited group. He also witnessed who the players were leaning on. It wasn't Blatt. It was Ty Lue. The team went to Denver for the final game of the trip. The next morning, NBA.com released a story examining shooting numbers across the league and determined James was having the worst jump shooting season of any contributing player. It pointed out he was shooting a miserable 28.5% outside the paint. His jumper indeed had looked off, and his three-point percentage had badly slipped. His form had suffered. He had a bad habit of leaning on his jumpers, which he'd battled his whole career, and the early season back issues had thrown off his rhythm. But no one realized how bad it had gotten until the numbers went public. After reading the article, James didn't wait for the bus, but instead took a car over to the arena early to get extra shooting in. "I saw it," was all he would say. Irving again had to sit because of the back-to-back, yo-yoing Blatt's options again. It didn't make much of a difference. James again was in a bad mood, and it was carrying over to the floor. The Cavs led the game throughout, and James had an answer for the shooting numbers, nailing a series of jumpers on his way to 34 points. The Cavs led from the start and picked up a win to end the road trip. Watching the game casually, that's all that would have been apparent. James was relieved by the performance, not so much because the team won, but because he hadn't flown off the handle to the media the night before in Phoenix when he was simmering with rage. Much of it, though perhaps not all, was aimed at Blatt. "Thank God we play in the NBA with the game the next day and not the NFL," James said, "because if it was the NFL, I would have went off and let the quotes fester for a week." Not watching the game casually was Griffin. A Phoenix native, he'd stayed in Arizona to spend time with family instead of going to Denver. As he watched, he grew more dejected as it played out. He saw James was dogging it. Over and over, Griffin watched as James didn't run back on defense, a half-quit showing Griffin knew was damaging. James set the example and the tone. Griffin later had his staff watch the film and count. 9. 9 times it happened, James not getting back on defense. Griffin hung his head, his family members realizing something was wrong. His team was up by 11 at the half. Why did he look sick to his stomach? He'd pondered it for some time, and he'd tried to put it off. But in that moment, Griffin came to the conclusion that he was going to have to fire David Blatt. The Cavs were in first place in the East. The team was in the midst of a transition as players returned from injury. James was hardly an ally, but he'd come to accept Blatt was his coach. Blatt was in the middle of a 3-year contract, and the Cavs were already paying off fired coach Mike Brown for the next 3 years. Exactly a year before, as the New Year's holiday arrived, Griffin had defended the coach when calls within the organization to fire Blatt arose, because he didn't believe he'd been given a fair chance. Now, he was feeling the opposite way. He'd just never seen a team that was more comfortable in dealing with adversity than it was with success. He believed Blatt, purposely or not, was a root cause. After winning in Denver, the team took 3 days off, which is unusual during the season. Even with extended breaks between games, typically teams practice. But after being away for Christmas, everyone needed a break. James didn't take the team charter back to Cleveland. Instead, a private plane was waiting, and he flew to Aspen, where he celebrated his 31st birthday and the new year with his wife, mother, and some friends. Other players went on brief trips and generally unplugged. When the team reconvened for practice on New Year's Day, Griffin sat in on the team's film session, and it was he who got on James about his actions in Denver. Not getting back on defense and his general attitude was a problem. That the GM was making the comments in the film session and not the coach was indicative of the dynamic that had existed between James and Blatt. For Blatt, this was a survival technique. He often had to try to set his agenda around James. This was untenable, but it was both of their faults. James for his frequent unwillingness to trust Blatt, but also Blatt for not setting a tone that all players would be held accountable. The team whipped the Magic by 25 in their first game of 2016 as James's hot shooting continued, including 4 3-pointers. During the break, he'd watched film of his shooting and analyzed how it had changed since he was in Miami, where he developed an excellent shooting touch. He made adjustments. They followed it up with a 22-point beating of Toronto, the team in second place in the East. Irving looked fantastic, racking up 25 points and displaying his full array of spin moves, crossovers, and speed changes that really showed his knee was improving. He did it against Raptors point guard Kyle Lowry, who had 23 points. After the game, the locker room was looser. As James was about to leave, Blatt came out of his office wearing only a towel and asked to meet with James. This was unusual. Coaches had their own dressing area and didn't walk through the locker room undressed like players. James was surprised, part amused and part annoyed. "Coach," he said, "I can't talk to you like this." James did go into Blatt's office. After a short talk, he came out. "That man was naked," he said as he left the room. It was a bizarre, though mostly lighthearted moment. It was also clear from its tenor that neither Blatt nor James knew that upstairs a decision to change coaches was under discussion. Griffin had gone to ownership and told them what he wanted to do. A year before, it was owner Dan Gilbert who was thinking a change had to be made, and Griffin asking for more time. Now the roles were reversed, and Gilbert was surprised by Griffin's intention. The team was about to leave on a 6-game road trip, and making a move during such a trip was unwise. At first, Nate Forbes and I weren't sure, but there was no doubt in Griff's mind we had to do it, Gilbert said. He had conviction about it. The team, though, kept winning. They made it 5 in a row in Washington, with James and Irving having classic performances. James scored 34 and Irving put up 32, outplaying Wizards star John Wall, who had 20 points. Wall had created a little stir a few days before the game when he openly complained that Irving was ahead of him in All-Star voting, despite missing most of the season, calling it a joke. The Wizards ran with it and made an actual joke. During a timeout in the second half, the video board showed a prepackaged skit or fans wearing Irving jerseys were asked which player was getting their All-Star vote, Irving or Wall. Naturally, they said Wall, and the point was made. But the Cavs players were watching. Irving was a demon down the stretch, scoring 19 points in the fourth quarter after seeing the video. "We didn't like it as a team," J.R. Smith said. "We didn't like it at all." "I saw it for sure," James said. "I really have no comment," Irving said. With the schedule soft, the Cavs' streak rolled on. They won in Minnesota and Philadelphia, two of the worst teams in the league, with ease. James had 37 points in Philly, making 15 of 22 shots as the shooting numbers continued to rise. The winning streak hit 8 in Dallas, as first Love and then Irving made clutch three-pointers in overtime. James's mood improved with the team and himself playing better. He even got back to saying kind words about Blatt, again making it clear that he was out of the loop of what was being considered in the front office. They were qualified comments, but they were positive. "I think every game is another learning experience for Coach Blatt," James told ESPN in an interview about the state of the team. "There's coaches with more tenure in our league, obviously, and there's guys with a better resume than he has. But one thing he tries to do is just put us in position to win, and then it's up to us. In sports, kind of the coaches always get the worst of it." Blatt remained hopeful that the two would develop a relationship, but he too was guarded. He'd seen James's mood swings before, one day patting him on the back, and the next day savaging him either to his face or behind his back. He kept hoping they could find some trust between each other. At the core, that didn't really exist, and Blatt knew it. "I think it's him and everyone else in the program recognizing that we were very, very close," Blatt said. "Perhaps the next step is the confidence in one another and that trust in one another." There really was no next step. There were few steps left between the Cavs and Blatt. He just didn't know it. The winning streak came to an end in San Antonio, where the Spurs were undefeated at home, and it showed. They overcame a 12-point Cavs lead to beat them. Irving was outplayed by Tony Parker, and James struggled to score at times on defensive ace Kawhi Leonard. That night, Blatt made another one of his PR missteps. The L.A. Clippers' DeAndre Jordan had gotten sick, breaking his streak of 360 consecutive games played. That meant the Cavs' Iron Man, Tristan Thompson, took over the streak for most consecutive games played, as he was playing in his 325th straight game. Blatt was asked about it. This, again, was a layup moment. The reporters needed a positive comment for their stories, and patting Thompson on the head was easy. Blatt dismissed it. "He didn't break a record. He's the current," Blatt said. "I'm leading the league in field goal percentage. I haven't missed a shot this year." No, it wasn't the record. A.C. Green has the record, with 1,192 straight games. It wasn't even the team record, but Thompson was proud, talking about playing through ankle sprains and food poisoning. Blatt shrugged. Another misread, another miffed player, another moment when Griffin was left scratching his head. The Cavs won by 14 the next night in Houston to finish the trip at 5-1. After he'd sometimes struggled to maintain positivity even after victories, James expressed his confidence in where the team was headed. He didn't worry about a close loss in San Antonio. For a moment, he'd even been willing to take his team off the Golden State standard. James said he believed the Cavs were good enough to beat any team in the league in a playoff series. He said it with a purpose. The Cavs were getting 2 days off and then hosting the Warriors. James felt they were ready. Irving was healthier than he'd been at Christmas. This long road trip had gone well. There was momentum, and James's comments would add to the motivation. At least he hoped. The day before the game, Curry needled the Cavs when he said he was looking forward to coming back to the visitors' locker room at Quicken Loans Arena. "Walking in that locker room, it'll be good memories," he said. "Hopefully, it still smells a little bit like champagne." The Cavs would have been fortunate had Curry stopped with trash talk. No. He and his teammates walked in with their 37-4 record not smelling champagne. They were smelling blood. The Cavs might have had some confidence after winning 9 of their previous 10 games, but their new rival had something on another level than confidence. They were running so hot and so smooth that they'd taken the game to an art form, their array of passes becoming a blur until they found an open man. Curry was making shots from everywhere with ease, some of them nearing 40 feet from the hoop. Draymond Green was becoming a Swiss Army knife, able to deploy different talents at different times, all of them useful. Klay Thompson's quick release and tremendous size made him a brutal assignment. The Warriors unleashed their full power at the Cavs, wanting to make a lasting statement on the terms of their relative standing. They embarrassed their hosts, crushing them 132-98, with Curry shooting and shimmy-shaking his way to 35 points. At one point, the Warriors got up 43 points, the most James had trailed in the 1,227 games of his NBA career. It was probably the most he'd been behind in any game in his life. It was beyond demoralizing. The Cavs had, rightly they believed, clung to a belief that the Warriors couldn't beat them when at full strength. This humbling night proved they were dead wrong. It was a miserable game for Love. Already, he'd predictably seen his role diminish since Irving came back. His scoring average dropped to 12.4 points a game from 17.6. He scored only 3 points and was exposed several times on defense, leading to highlights filling social media and questions arising about his fitness to play against the Warriors lineup. Smith showed his dark side again, tackling Warriors forward Harrison Barnes and being ejected for the flagrant foul. In the fourth quarter, the game was decided and the starters were pulled. With the game in hand, Warriors interim coach Luke Walton, filling in for coach Steve Kerr because of an illness, sat down. Blatt didn't have the option. Sitting in his seat on the bench was James, chewing on Lou's ear and venting. This was very public, but the reality was just as symbolic. James said nice things sometimes, but he'd long since effectively walled off Blatt and made Lou his most meaningful contact on the coaching staff. Afterward, Blatt tried to shoulder some blame, saying he didn't have the team ready. It was deeper than that. The Cavs weren't equipped to handle what the Warriors, on their way to setting a regular season win record, were throwing at them. Naturally, after such a setback, Blatt was in line to be reviewed, and that happened. But it was not about the coach. One team was just way ahead of the other. Tonight was an example how far we've got to go to get to a championship level, James said. They definitely played like champions, Irving said. They came in and just kicked our ass. When asked about the state of the team, Love gave a strange answer. It's going to take a lot of guys looking at themselves in the mirror, and it starts with our leader over there, he said, gesturing to James's locker. Was Love, after a horrible personal performance, pointing at James as the culprit? James certainly thought so. The next day, he called a team meeting so things could be aired out. Love said his point was misconstrued. All I meant was that LeBron is our leader and we follow him at the end of the day, he said. We all got to be better for each other, him, our fans, our organization, each other, and every player on this team, our coaches. James talked to Love personally about the quote and cleared the air after the misstep. We talked about it, he said. I take the man at his word. There were other discussions going on, though, between Gilbert and Griffin. The Blatt issue had been in the air for a few weeks. Gilbert still wasn't sure it was the right call. He'd fired plenty of coaches over the previous 10 years, and he had been talked out of firing more. In this case, he was conflicted, but he decided that he'd support his general manager and clear the way for the firing. This wasn't always the case for Gilbert. He'd acted on his own before, regardless of his GM's wishes. But this time it was going to be on Griffin's shoulders, and the results would be on them as well. Gilbert gave his blessing. It was all Griff, and it took a lot of balls, Gilbert said. I told him, Griff, they're going to kill us. We're leading the East, and we're going to fire our coach in the middle of the year. Here's what it came down to. In my gut, heart, and soul, can we win the NBA championship with this coach? He's a good man. He's a good human being. But can these players rally around him? The answer we had to realize was likely not. We had Ty there. If we didn't have Ty, I don't think we could do it. The team had a back-to-back coming up in Brooklyn and then a home game with the Clippers. After that, there was an off day. Blatt would be let go. The team won in Brooklyn, Love bouncing back with 17 points and 18 rebounds. Then they had a nice 3-point home victory over the Clippers, one of the West's best teams. Love was strong again with 18 points and 16 rebounds, as James delivered 22 points and 12 assists. It seemed like a stabilizing win. It was not. Blatt had no idea it was coming. He again admonished the media for criticism and praised his team for their ability to battle through adversity. "I hear a lot of far-reaching conclusions, and I personally don't like it," he said. "But there's nothing I can do about it. I think this team has done pretty well dealing with the adversity that we've had. I think this team is in pretty good position, although people choose to overlook that, which I don't think is fair. It's about my team. It's about my guys, and I don't like it. I don't like it at all," he said, his confidence rising after the win. "This wasn't promised to us. Nobody gave us that. We had to work for it, and they've been working hard and doing a good job overall, a really good job." In many people's eyes, it was a good job. It was the exact halfway point of the season, and the team was 30-11 and in first place. A few more wins, and Blatt would clinch being named East Coach for the All-Star Game in Toronto 2 weeks later. The next morning, a Friday, Griffin asked to talk to Blatt. Because of the back-to-back the previous 2 days, the team had been given the day off, and the practice facility was mostly empty. Griffin told Blatt he was being let go. Blatt was stunned. His coaches were shocked. His peers in the league were angry. The nation of Israel would later become outraged. Griffin called Lou, who wasn't yet at work. Like Blatt, Lou was blindsided. He didn't agree with the decision. Lou had wanted this job 18 months earlier. At one point, he thought he had it. He ended up in the unorthodox position of being the lead assistant to a man who beat him for the job. Griffin had leaned toward Lou at the time, but he accepted the Blatt choice. After seeing Lou work up close, Griffin was convinced he was going to be a good head coach. Griffin saw Lou connected with the players, some of whom used to be his peers when he played in the league. But he was more impressed Lou was not afraid to hold players accountable. It was an historic decision, firing a coach in first place at midseason, but Griffin was doing it because he also believed in Lou, not because he thought Blatt had failed. He told Lou he would not be interim coach. He wanted him to be the new permanent head coach. He offered him a contract extension and a raise. Lou was concerned how it looked, like he might have undermined Blatt to get the job. He didn't sign the contract because he didn't want to make it seem like he'd been negotiating, but he did accept the job. Blatt had been given a difficult hand when he showed up the first day in 2014, weeks before James had signed and Love was traded for. He'd made mistakes, perhaps the largest being not recognizing just how big a change coaching in the NBA would be from his European roots. It was blatant. He saw the two as somewhat parallel, and it was just as obvious that that was an error in judgment. People in the NBA, players in the NBA, don't see it equally, and Blatt learned the hard way. "When I came to the NBA, I was under the impression that this was going to be a breeze," he said before starting his second season. "I've been coaching for 20 years at the highest level in Europe. I coached in the national team environment, coached professional teams, coached EuroLeague teams. I thought I knew basketball, and I thought I knew how to coach, which in my mind, I did. But I realized when I came over here, it was a very, very different game, with a whole new set of problems and a whole new slew of things to deal with inside and outside of the game." Ultimately, he was never able to bridge that gap. He may never have won James over. When Blatt wasn't able to hold James accountable, he gave up any hope of finding any real footing. Griffin believed Lou could perform better in that role. "I think it was clear to everyone what was going on," Gilbert said. "LeBron wants to be challenged, and that's hard because he can be intimidating. David just wasn't able to connect." Griffin asked the team leaders to gather for a team meeting at 3:30 that afternoon. They were scattered, none of them expecting to have to come in that day. When they got together, the word was out, but they still weren't totally sure what happened. They joked that they were getting called in to be told Love had been traded, because those rumors raged after Love's poor game against the Warriors. There was an assumption by outsiders James was involved with the move, because of his well-known issues with Blatt. He also had a connection with Lou, which dated to James's teenage years when Lou was in the league. But Griffin didn't tell James prior to the firing. He didn't feel the need to ask. James's actions had made his feelings on the matter plain. This would become a point of contention for those evaluating the unusual coaching change. Common sense dictated James, the center of the franchise, would be involved in such a major transaction. Some could never be convinced that he wasn't consulted. But Griffin, Gilbert, and James swear it not to be true. James didn't perform the coup de grace. That was Griffin. James did do damage along the way. Both of these statements can be true, and both men could end up being correct in their assessment of Blatt's job performance. For decades, star players have played a role in coaching changes. For decades, star players have been blamed for forcing coaches out regardless of the truth. Often, there's little room for nuance in understanding what happened. None of that will change in the future. James knew the score. "Like it or love it or hate it, we've got to respect it," he said. "I can't get caught up and worried about what other people are thinking. I stopped doing that a long time ago in my career." After the team meeting, Lou and James had a private conversation. "I told them, I got to hold you accountable. It starts with you first. And if I can hold you accountable in front of the team and doing the right things, then everybody else has got to fall in line, fall in place." James may not have admitted it publicly, but he longed at times to play for a former player. His first head coach, Paul Silas, was a former player, but there was more than a 40-year age gap. It was like a grandfather-grandson relationship, especially given how protective Silas was of the young James at the time. After that, it was 10 years of tacticians, former video coordinators like Brown and Eric Spoelstra, grinders who grew up in the league but never played. Blatt was from, it felt to James, another world. Even when he was playing for the Olympic team, it was under Mike Krzyzewski, a legend, but not a player. James had connected to former players turned coaches like Doc Rivers, going against him for years. Lou was a Rivers disciple, having coached with him in Boston and L.A. "We've been friends since I was 17 years old, but at the end of the day, he's still the coach and I'm underneath him," James said about Lou. "He will coach me and push me, and I'll listen to everything he has to say and go from there. Don't try to make it a story of why me and Coach Lou are so tight. I think it's a lot of coaches and players that's close in this league. It just happened to be me." And that was happening for the first time in James's career. Griffin called a news conference to explain the decision. Gilbert was not there, which was right. This was Griffin's decision, and he intended to take full ownership of it. David spent the last year and a half under incredible scrutiny. He was doing it without his family, and he was working to mold a group of individuals that are incredibly willful, Griffin said. "That's not easy, and I understand that. Decisions like these tend to make themselves. Every decision is made with an answer to the following question. Does it put us in the best position to deliver championships? I go to bed every night thinking about that question." Griffin talked about the lack of connection he felt within the team. He talked about how the players weren't showing buy-in to the coach. He explained it wasn't based on the win-loss record. How could it be? It was about the bigger picture. Are our hearts, minds, and souls in what we're doing? Are we really trying to achieve something as a unit? Griffin said he asked himself. We need to build a collective spirit. Halfway through this season, we have failed. Each step forward has been followed by two steps back. Pretty good is not what we're here for. We're pretty good right now. That's not what we're in the business to be. Then he insisted no player had anything directly to do with the decision, saying, "I'm not taking a poll. My job is to lead a franchise. I didn't ask anyone's opinion. I'm in the locker room. I know what it's supposed to feel like." There were opinions, though. There had been heavy coaching turnover across the NBA over the previous 2 years, and the league's coaches felt like they were under attack. "I'm embarrassed for our league that something like this could happen," Dallas coach Rick Carlisle said. "It's just bizarre. It just leaves you with a bit of an empty feeling because Blatt's a great guy, and he did a great job there." "He had the most scrutinized job that you could possibly had," said Rivers, who a day earlier had seen his team vanquished by Blatt's Cavs. "I think the reward for coaching LeBron is you get scrutinized. It's hard. They have a great record, the best in the East, and you get fired for it. Back in my day, you used to have to at least lose games before you got fired," Orlando coach Scott Skiles said. That one, to me, elevated all of the coach firings totally into the theater of the absurd, said Pistons coach Stan Van Gundy. It was insane. After his team became the latest to take a 30-point beating at the hands of Golden State, the Spurs' legendary coach Greg Popovich took aim at Griffin. I'm just glad my general manager wasn't in the locker room, because it might have gotten me fired, Popovich said, mocking Griffin's comment that his observations in the locker room led to the Blatt firing. 20 years earlier, Popovich had been a general manager when he fired his coach, Bob Hill, and put himself in the job. So it was ironic that Popovich would hit Griffin, but it was just a part of a growing course. Already with a massive payroll and huge expectations, the Blatt firing had upped the ante for both James and Griffin. History was going to judge them on this. They were both aware of it. And they were also aware that when sudden changes happened to teams, whether it was a coaching move or a major trade, sometimes things got worse before they got better. Chapter 14. That's What the Coach Wants. Kyrie Irving was gulping for air, his chest burning so badly from exertion that he fouled Jimmy Butler, the Chicago Bulls all-star guard, out of fatigue so he could get out of the game. When he got to the bench, Kevin Love was already sitting there with the same symptoms. A few seconds later, there was LeBron James slumping into the chair near him, chest heaving and asking for the water bottle. There were 5 minutes left in the first quarter. Why were all of the Cavs stars on the bench? We're not in good enough shape right now to play the way I want to play, Ty Lue said, explaining why his players were gassed moments into his first game as coach. Lue's first 48 hours on the job were forceful. He was a popular teammate and coach, and congratulatory messages from friends and acquaintances poured in when his promotion became public. In the hours after taking the job, he received 716 text messages. It was a good day for me, Lue said, and a bad day for Blatt. Amid the stress of the changeover, Lue was concerned about the perception that he'd undercut Blatt to get the job. It's natural for there to be speculation when an assistant replaces a head coach. In Lue's situation, it was unavoidable, despite all parties denying it. Lue had been preparing himself to be a head coach, and there were times during Blatt's tenure when he must have wondered about his boss's job security. But on this move, he'd been in the dark. I know how loyal I was to Coach Blatt, and the people that know me understand that, Lue told Cleveland.com. I have no control over what people think. I have a job to do, and I'm going to do my best. Lue didn't even get to hold a full practice before his first game, but he used his new authority anyway. He said he wouldn't be doing things differently from Blatt, but he planned to do them better. One of his first moves was to tell the players they were going back to a traditional approach when it came to pregame introductions. For months, the Cavs players did not run out and high-five teammates when the starting lineups were called. With the scoreboard flashing elaborate videos and fire shooting from giant swords in the ceiling, the team had adopted an approach where they huddled together. It was James who came up with the concept. He wanted to promote focus before tip-off. Blatt agreed. This was the sort of thing he would not challenge James on anyway, and it became policy. In an effort to lighten the mood, Lue said that policy was finished, at least for home games. When they call your name, run out, be introduced, Lue told the players. That's what the coach wants. That's what we'll do, James said. There's no fighting, no ifs, ands, or buts. It may have seemed trivial, but from the start, Lue was setting a tone that he would be issuing some edicts. The concept of calling his players, many of whom were proud of their world-class athlete status, out of shape on day one was a little more complex, but took guts. Lue wanted to play more up-tempo. He didn't like that the Cavs ranked as the third slowest team in the league in possessions per game under Blatt. He intended to hit the accelerator and called players out by name who couldn't keep up. The Bulls trounced the Cavs in Lue's first game, beating them 96-83. The result was secondary to Lue's objective of changing attitude and focus. 2 days later, James put a shirtless photo on social media following a 7 a.m. workout in his home weight room as he stood next to a personalized Golden Lion Nike logo emblazoned on the padded floor. He was clearly in top physical condition, which was the point he was making in his own way after Lou had implied his players were out of shape. "I don't think I'm in bad shape at all. Just need to get in better shape for what we want to do," he said. "I'm not that far off. I can get there in less than a week." Lou had other pieces of business. He hired a past colleague, Mike Longobardi, to join his coaching staff. Lou had previously been in charge of the Cavs' defense, with Blatt, such as it was, in charge of the offense. He wanted to take over the offense, and he brought Longobardi in to handle his old role. Part of what Lou wanted was to engage Irving more. Lou thought sometimes he worried too much about his role in the offense and did not focus enough on pure aggression. A year after James had chided Irving for not passing enough, Lou said to worry about attacking first and passing second. The team won the next two games, slaying league weaklings Minnesota and Phoenix. The victories assured the team would have the East's best record going into the All-Star break, and therefore Lou would be the All-Star coach. It was unprecedented and awkward, a coach who'd been in charge for three games being declared an All-Star. Lou suggested Blatt be allowed to come back and coach the game in Toronto, fully knowing there was no way that would happen. Other than James and Lou, though, there would be no other Cavs who would make it. The Raptors' Kyle Lowry passed Irving in votes, getting in as a starter, and the league's coaches passed over Love for the second straight year. He answered by putting up 29 points with 5 3-pointers in a win over Detroit, as Irving added 28 and James 20. It was the first time all season the three each scored over 20 in a game. The pace was growing, as Lou wanted, and the scoring was going up. The questions to the players started pouring in, asking them to compare Lou and Blatt. For the most part, they avoided direct comparisons. However, James dropped hints, repeatedly praising Lou and adopting a submissive role. "Coach gets on us in film sessions. Coach Lou is the captain of the ship. We've got to do whatever he barks out. It's great to have a leader like Coach Lou." Then again, he had given Blatt lip service at times too. James had taken some criticism from fans and media after Blatt's exit. The term coach killer was used, which James found insulting. While his feelings toward Blatt were mostly out in the open by then, plenty drew their own conclusions. The coach killer tag ate at James because he felt just the opposite. He felt that throughout his career, he'd uplifted coaches. He helped them win awards, helped them get raises, helped get them other jobs. His first high school coach, Keith Dambrot, got a college job and was then a successful head coach at the University of Akron. James had been pulling coaches up since he was 16. In short, he felt he was worth any sort of challenges that may have come with him. More important, James and the team appeared to be responding to the changes Lou was pushing, and the distractions involving the coach had been eliminated. A big moment came when the Cavs whipped the San Antonio Spurs 117-103. The Spurs came in with the league's best defense, and the Cavs ran them out of the gym. It was the first victory against one of the top teams from the West, a flaw that had been gnawing at the team. Once again, Irving, Love, and James all topped 20 points. The next night, they won in Indiana, with four players scoring 19 or more points. Over the previous two seasons, though, it had become apparent the Cavs were rarely able to hold on to positive vibes. General manager David Griffin had developed a saying, partly out of despair, that the Cavs hated prosperity and loved adversity. So right after Lou looked like he was getting some traction and the changes were paying off with a 5-game win streak, the team dumped back-to-back games in Charlotte and at home to Boston. The loss to the Celtics was harsh. They managed to blow a 4-point lead in the final 7 seconds after an ill-timed foul and a defensive breakdown let the Celtics construct a stunning 5-point possession. With the offense in overdrive, the team's defense started to rapidly decline. That had been a calling card and had carried them in the postseason the year before. Lou's proficiency in running that aspect had been one of the things that had impressed both the players and front office. Now he'd given it up and preached speed and scoring. Attention to detail on defense was predictably slipping. Right now, we're still kind of running old stuff and new stuff and trying to combine it, and it's kind of messing the guys' heads up, Lou said. That's on me. That's my fault. James's positive vibes came to an end after the Boston loss. After scoring 30 points, he was so frustrated that he immediately reported to the weight room for an unusual post-game workout in an effort to get his anger out. The Cavs won the next three games, with their offense continuing to zoom. They beat the Pelicans by 15, with Irving scoring 29 as Lou continued to urge aggression. Smith made 6 three-pointers in that win and 6 more in the next game as they smashed the Sacramento Kings by 20. Irving had 32 in that one, hitting 5 three-pointers of his own after he entered the game shooting a career-worst 25% on them. In the final game before All-Star Weekend, the Cavs put up 120 points on the Los Angeles Lakers, and Irving was terrific again, scoring a season-high 35. Lou's pushing helped, but Irving's knee getting healthier was a factor. James and Kobe Bryant had been connected for the previous decade as the faces of the NBA, but the real relationship was between Irving and Bryant. They had become friendly. Bryant isn't really friends with many, especially competitors, and it gave Irving tremendous pride to play so well against him as he went through the final season of his 20-year career. Irving knew that in Bryant's final game against his hero, Michael Jordan, he'd scored 55 points. The Cavs and Lakers were to play once more, but Irving wanted to deliver such a game to guarantee a memory. Bryant didn't play very well with a bad knee and shoulder, scoring 17 points. For Irving, it was a dream. Going against your mentor, one of the guys that you want to prove something to every time you go out and play, there was definitely some added incentive going in there, Irving said. He has a killer mentality, Bryant said of Irving. He can shoot the long ball, his mid-range game is excellent, and he can finish at the rim. He has all the tools there. The way he played tonight, he can do this pretty much every night. The team broke for All-Star Weekend, a plane waiting to take James and the coaching staff to Toronto after the victory, with other players having their own flight plans to Mexico and the Caribbean. Irving went to Los Angeles to spend Valentine's Day with his girlfriend, the singer Kalani Parrish. There would be no vacation for Griffin, who was engaged in trade talks with several teams. He was trying to find a way to add some more shooting, as he felt it was going to be vital to have versatility in the upcoming playoffs. He was also on the lookout for another big man. Timofey Mozgov had been in and out of the starting lineup all season. He had moments, but his knee wasn't fully healthy, and it affected his confidence. A year before, the Cavs had traded 2 first-round picks for him, and he'd been a key piece in their playoff run. But as he headed towards free agency, the Cavs were having a tough time seeing him as a long-term answer. The issue for Griffin was making a move without adding to the payroll. The Cavs were sitting about $110 million in salaries, and that would come with luxury tax charges approaching $70 million for going so far over the salary cap. The player Griffin wanted was Channing Frye, a good shooting big man who played for the Orlando Magic. The Cavs had seen Frye as a great fit alongside James as far back as 2009, when they chased him in free agency. In 2014, Griffin went after him again, but both times Frye took better offers. He was now having a down season, averaging just 5 points, and the Magic had made him available. But his salary was $8 million, and Orlando didn't want to take back long-term salary in a deal. The Los Angeles Clippers were also in the bidding and felt like they might be able to get him. Several things fell into place in the last 24 hours before the trade deadline. The Clippers couldn't close the deal with Orlando and moved on to a different trade. Griffin then found a way to make the deal work financially, as he got the Portland Trailblazers to trade for Anderson Varejao, taking $10 million off the team's books and making room for Frye in a 3-team deal. It cost the Cavs a first-round pick, their 2018 selection, and they had to trade a popular player who'd been with the team for 12 seasons. But Griffin got his desired shooting big man, and in the transaction, the Cavs were able to save about $10 million in salary and taxes. That was a very difficult phone call to have, Griffin said. There's very little I've enjoyed less in my professional career than letting Andy know he was traded. Varejao was crushed, and it got worse when the Blazers immediately cut him. They'd only done the trade to get the first-round pick. The NBA is a business, so Varejao responded with his own business move and signed with the Warriors, his old team's central rival. The first game after the deal was against the Bulls. Now, several weeks into Lou's regime, the performance was more stable and honed. James tossed in 25, and Love added 15 points and 14 rebounds as they beat the Bulls for the first time all season. 2 days later, they went to Oklahoma City on a Saturday afternoon, arriving in the early evening ahead of their nationally televised Sunday afternoon game against the Thunder. As with the Spurs game 2 weeks prior, this was a test. They'd been putting together wins, but real progress was choppy. After dinner, players headed back to the Skirvin Hotel, a grand old building 3 blocks from the arena, where all visiting teams stay. It has a reputation for being haunted. Over the years, players have reported hearing strange noises, including crying babies in the middle of the night. When Wesley Johnson was playing for the Phoenix Suns, he awoke one morning to find his bathroom door closed and his bathtub inexplicably filled with water. At 3 a.m., Irving woke up in his room with an itching feeling on his body. It wasn't a ghost. He flipped on the light and saw bedbugs crawling around his sheets and pillow. Just imagine how freaked out you'd be if you saw friggin' 5 big bedbugs just sitting on your pillow, Irving said. I woke up itching, and I'm just looking around, and I'm like, are you serious right now? I was so tired at that point. Irving yanked off his clothes and tried to sleep on the couch in his room. He abandoned most of the clothes he had in the room and left shaken. Midway through the first quarter the next afternoon, he told the trainers he was feeling ill. He went to the locker room and was done for the game. The critters seemed to have gotten into his head. I was freaked out, and then I started feeling nauseous, he said. Hilton, which runs the Skirvin, admitted what Irving knew, that management had found the bugs in the room. The hotel offered a formal apology. While Irving was trying to keep it together, the team didn't seem all that affected by his departure. They smashed the Thunder by 23. The enigma that was Love did it again. Sometimes when James or Irving missed a game, Love became ineffective. Other times, he took advantage of the extra shots in space. This game was the latter. He had one of his best performances of the season, with 29 points and 11 rebounds. In one of the pinnacle moments of the season for the team, they played terrifically in all facets and looked every bit the championship contender they were in vanquishing a high-quality opponent on the road. In typical fashion, they then went back home the next day and lost momentum by losing to the Detroit Pistons, though Irving was over his bedbug-induced anxiety and scored 30 points. Just when it looked like they had gained some acceleration with the Bulls and Thunder wins, they unexpectedly slid into a dark period. A visit to Toronto, the team with the second-best record in the East, went poorly when the Cavs blew a 9-point lead with 5 minutes to play. Lowry was sensational and repeatedly burned Irving as he scored a career-high 43 points, including the game-winner at the buzzer. He'd played against Irving many times, and Irving had plenty of victories on his belt from the rivalry, but this one was lopsided. Irving had just 10 points and 1 assist. He had a hell of a game, James said. But that's what all-stars do. That could have been just a compliment, or it could have been one of James' little digs in referencing how Lowry had beaten out Irving for an all-star spot. Lowry got it because of a huge Canadian voting push to have one of their players start the game, which was being played in Toronto. Irving wasn't voted in by the coaches because he had missed so much time with injury. Irving had been an all-star twice before. His status wasn't in question. Nonetheless, it felt like a bit of a jab after he had been so outplayed. Whatever it was a tremor before a passive-aggressive James Storm was about to arrive. James skipped the next game. He'd been worn down a little and took the night off in Washington. The underachieving Wizards drilled the Cavs, getting up by as many as 29 points against a lifeless defense. James was so frustrated he left the bench with 5 minutes to go and was off to the bus within minutes of the end of the game. Lou yanked all his frontline players except for Irving, whom for some reason he played until the bitter end. Irving ended up scoring 28 points, but he was in the game either as some form of punishment or because it reached a point where he didn't want to come out. Against the Pacers, the team was headed for a third straight loss at home, but rallied in the fourth quarter to win. When our backs are against the wall, that's when we tend to play harder, Lou said. It's annoying. At this juncture, annoyance was growing around the team. A report appeared in the media that Irving had grown unhappy in Cleveland playing alongside James. In truth, many of James's teammates got unhappy with him at times. Love and Irving had their bouts with it the season before, for sure. But Love and Irving also knew they'd never seen the playoffs before they got on the same team with James. There were rewards to dealing with occasional downsides. Irving, however, didn't exactly kill the story when the chance arose after the win over the Pacers. "There's nothing really to address," he said. "Obviously, there's going to be some misunderstandings. It's part of being on a team." The team had 3 days off and some decompression was needed. Lou told the players they'd have 2 straight days with no practice. James and his wife got away and flew to Miami. The time was his to use. It was warm in Florida and cold in Cleveland. But he allowed his dinner and workouts with Dwayne Wade to make it onto social media, letting the world know of his mid-season side trip. Then, while in Miami, he sent out a cryptic tweet that read, "It's okay to know you've made a mistake, 'cause we all do at times. Just be ready to live with whatever comes with it and be with those who will protect you at all cost." Just like the year before, with his tweets about love, many assumed this was directed at a teammate. With the Irving events, some concluded it was aimed at him. James denied it was for anyone on his team and brushed off people who wondered why he'd go hang out with Wade in the middle of a season. "I don't care," he said dismissively. Then it was back to Twitter with another pointed comment with an uncertain target. "Can't replace being around great friends that reciprocate the same energy back to you in all facets of life." Again, assumptions were made that he was saying he liked being with Wade more than his own teammates. Again, James didn't explain himself. That he was scheduled to become a free agent this summer fed some unwanted speculation. On a video that Richard Jefferson took and put on social media, James mocked the media and the overheated analysis. As he was eating a banana, James pretended he was a reporter asking him, "Why are you eating a banana, LeBron? Does that mean you're going to slip on a banana peel out of Cleveland?" Then again, James had left in free agency twice before in his career. The idea wasn't exactly ludicrous, and his behavior was a challenge to read. There were more important things going on. While the team was on hiatus, the front office was working hard to land Joe Johnson, the veteran shooting guard who secured his release from the Brooklyn Nets and was now a free agent. The Cavs put on a strong recruiting process, believing he could help as a role player off the bench, and that he would want to come compete for a title. James made several recruiting pitches. The two knew each other from Team USA. But Johnson rejected the Cavs and instead signed in Miami, visiting the Heat at the same time James was there on his mini-vacation. As they seemed to do in such times, the Cavs pivoted. They came back from their break with 2 excellent wins, getting retribution on the Wizards by winning by 25 points, and then making up for the ugly loss to the Celtics by beating them by 17. And on cue, they backed that up with a miserable loss to the Memphis Grizzlies. Missing 5 of their top 7 players because of injury, the Grizzlies only had 8 players in uniform. Tony Allen, the team's veteran defensive specialist, came away with 26 points, the most he'd scored in more than 5 years. "We didn't respect them," James said. "I can sit up here and say that we're a team that's ready to start the playoffs, but we're not." The team rebounded by winning 3 of 4 on a Western road trip. They won in Sacramento, putting up 120 points as Irving had 30 and James 25. The team spent 4 days in Los Angeles, where James played his final game against Bryant. The two stars never had much of a relationship when they were both in their prime. They played together on the 2008 Olympic team, but there was a distance between them even as teammates, which Bryant preferred anyway. Between 2007 and 2016, either Bryant or James would be in every finals, but they never played against each other. The nearest miss was in 2009, when James's Cavs lost to the Magic in the conference finals. That left a hole in their rivalry. In 2010, after the Lakers had won back-to-back titles, Bryant needled James when he signed with the Miami Heat. Just after the announcement, he sent James a text. "Go ahead and get another MVP if you want, and find the city you want to live in. But we're going to win the championship. Don't worry about it." James won 2 MVPs and 2 titles in Miami. Bryant was done winning as the later stages of his career were wrecked with injuries. but he had his 5 rings to lord over James. As Bryant mellowed in his final 2 years in the league, the barrier between the two started to come down. Searching for a way to overcome the injury